Please be seated. First up this morning is State versus Sage.
Good morning. Nancy Collins here on behalf of Jonathan Sage. If I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. We ask this court to reverse Mr. Sage's convictions due to double jeopardy violations and numerous instances of improper and prejudicial evidence that swayed the jury. The double jeopardy issue is relatively straightforward. We ask this court to reverse counts 2 and 4 because the jury's verdict does not reflect unanimous agreement about separate and distinct conduct.
Before we get into that discussion,
yes.
Can you help us make sure we understand your challenge to judicial fact-finding on the exceptional sentence? I guess as I read your references to the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Hearst and our Supreme Court's decision in Friedland, I'm kind of wondering, is the essence of your argument that Solomon and Hughes are incorrect, which you have argued, when they say that it's all that remains for the trial court is a question of law?
Yes, that there are underlying factual determinations in that.
So if you don't prevail on that issue, then does that resolve your judicial fact-finding? I mean, is this an issue you're planning to take potentially the Supreme Court on that?
That's essentially, I think that you summarize it, the crux of that argument, that it is really factual determinations that are within that, especially in this particular case. So, yes.
Okay. I wanted to make sure we weren't missing some other nuance.
I hope not. I think so.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Then I'll just move to the evidentiary issues in this case, which are more complicated, but together require a new trial. Our courts have established that the potential for prejudice is at its highest when there are allegations of sex offenses, and the trial court in such a case must carefully and methodically review the evidence for trial that the state seeks to present as part of its case. It's the purpose of ER 404B and ER 403 is to keep out evidence that is prejudicial and lacks sufficient probative value. Here, the defense asked for such a move in pretrial to exclude all evidence of prior misconduct unless the state came forward and explained what it wanted to introduce and why it was relevant, and the court made that ruling as required by our case law. And that didn't occur for all the instances of the evidence here. For example, there are allegations that Mr. Sage was filming sex with EM, which is manufacturing child pornography, that he was particularly dangerous because he had a gun and ammunition that he kept in a air place that was easily accessible to EM, who contemplated taking that gun and using it on himself or others, Mr. Sage, for example. There's allegations of sexual conduct with a dog. It is the type of evidence that has the true power to really disgust, has a real visceral impact. Defense counsel urged the court to not admit that evidence pretrial, and the court did over objection. Even though it really was not intertwined, the child, even when testifying at trial, described the incident without any reference to anything but the dog. It had to be prompted by the prosecutor to discuss that information because it wasn't intertwined. It didn't always happen. But again, it was not the kind of, but it has such a powerful evidence that the kind of thing the jury can't get past when looking at these type of allegations.
It seems like the court made a fairly detailed, articulate ruling walking through the 404B analysis.
On that particular
on
bit of evidence.
All the issues?
The only evidence that the prosecutor put before the court before trial that it wanted to introduce was this allegation about the dog and allegations of uncharged conduct beyond the charging period and such, this sort of host of other evidence they wanted to introduce of similar sort of type, similar behavior beyond the counts specifically charged, but didn't address these other things in its pretrial ruling. They weren't mentioned. They weren't proffered by the prosecutors, things that it intended to introduce and that it wanted that sort of 404B analysis on, which is one of the reasons why it shouldn't have been admitted. But even looking at the evidence itself, it was certainly far more prejudicial than probative here. And taking that together with, you also have the courtroom behavior of E.M. when he came into court and made gestures that the defense counsel found to be very horrifying and prejudicial to her client. And she was apparently the only one in the courtroom that was watching him and the jury at the same time, seeing their reactions, engaging that. She moved for a mistrial immediately, and the court deny that request, but having not, didn't observe with how the jury reacted to it and didn't see the full host of what happened and didn't hear what happened, the way defense counsel seemed to be in a unique position to see and hear, and she immediately felt like that it was very damaging and not the kind of thing that an instruction would cure, but deny her request for a mistrial.
Back to your double jeopardy argument.
Yes.
Why didn't the Munch tells us that we need to look at the entire record. Why didn't the closing argument that identified the separate and distinct acts cure or make manifest that this wasn't a double jeopardy violation?
Well, Munch says beyond simply an argument, you really need a sort of the factual scenario. Like in Munch, where there were only five counts, and those undisputed that they occurred here in that case, which is not true here. In Munch, it was simply a consent event. Yes, we agree all five of those things happened. They're the only five things that happened. And here you have multiple allegations, some far more ambiguous than others, over extended charging period. No agreement that any of them happened. The defense is a denial of any of these, that any of these occurred. And there was no instruction to the jury. And Munch says it's only the rare instance that we would say this could be harmless, and that we find this to be the rare instance because they were undisputed that those the acts had occurred. It was simply whether those acts met the elements of the crime or not. So while Munch says we're going to find it harmless here, they go out of their way to say this is the very rare circumstance where we will. And that's not the scenario here, where you have these multiple allegations. There's some ambiguity. The complainants themselves don't remember instances and dates and allegations themselves. So an election or not, wasn't even an election, I would say. The closing argument themselves is simply not enough.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Greg Banks, Island County Prosecutor on behalf of the state of Washington. Mr. Stage received the process he was due. He had ultimately a fair trial and was found guilty of all four counts, four separate and distinct counts. And Judge Schindler, I'd like to pick up on the point that you made.
Before you do that, why didn't you propose a separate and distinct jury instruction?
Well, I can't answer for my deputy prosecutor. I suspect because he didn't realize he needed to. You know, it's off the record. His understanding was that it was incumbent upon him to make the distinction during opening and closing. And I think he fairly did in closing argument. And Munch backs off of or disapproves of this court's decision in Berg,
right,
and says that the flaws in the jury instructions don't automatically create a double jeopardy violation. And I think that's consistent with many other areas of this sort of law that surround instructional errors.
What the court says in Munch is that we should look at the entire record, which would include, as we just heard, the testimony and the closing argument.
Exactly. And I think when the court does that, that the outcome in this case should be that the jury did understand that these were separate and distinct violations, that it was manifestly apparent the state was not seeking to punish Mr. Stage twice for the same acts.
Well, I think the testimony was clear as to the first instance for both of the boys. But what about the second or distinct other act?
Well, and what happens frequently in cases of child sex abuse is that they're reported somewhat later. These were not that late, although they were late reports, and there were many, many incidents over a period of almost 3 years. And what these boys both remembered was the first incidents, and they remembered it happening in the case of JM multiple times per week, he said, for a long period of time, and then the frequency tapered off. Similarly with EM, they didn't have they had very few incidents that they could differentiate from the others, other than the boys both testify they happened in multiple locations, and which is, I note, similar to the Ortiz-Lopez, the unpublished decision that we cited under 14.1 in our brief. And the boys were just not that clear. And so that's why prosecutors are permitted to charge these offenses as occurring over a range of dates, because there's frequently so much ambiguity in these reports. But the touchstone of proof beyond a reasonable doubt is there. The unanimity instructions were there. And the jury apparently had sufficient evidence to be unanimous as to more than one incident with each of the boys. As far as the instructions go, there's one instruction that I didn't call out in my brief, which I think also lends some weight to the idea that the jury understood that these were separate and distinct counts, and that's instruction number 25. I think it's 25. Correct. It's the concluding instruction, and in the paragraphs dealing with the aggravating factors, the court instructs the jury, if you find the defendant not guilty of these, this is as to counts one and two only, if you find the defendant not guilty of these crimes, do not use the special verdict forms. If you find the defendant guilty of either of these crimes, you will then use the special verdict forms for that crime or crimes. So again, the court is, though not explicitly doing so, is drawing the distinction that as to counts one and two, there are two crimes that are being discussed here, and then there's a parallel paragraph dealing with counts three and four that follows that same language, but it just says counts three and four.
That doesn't really add much to the analysis of whether those are separate and distinct, though, right? Any more than having separate to convict instructions.
I think it adds incrementally. It's one more thing in the instruction that goes along with the instruction number two, which says a separate crime is charged in each count, with the Petrich instructions that occurred after each of the elements instructions. And then also considering the arguments of both counsel, not just the prosecutor, but the defense counsel, even in her closing argument, made the point that, well, you know, she was trying to argue that the prosecutor was dealing with this cloud of offenses and it was ambiguous, and, you know, said, why are they parsing them out? They're doing it because they're separate crimes. And if much tells us anything, it's what did the jury perceive or understand about the state's intent? Was the state intending to prosecute this person twice for the same act, or were they intending to prosecute and convict Mr. Sage for separate acts? And that's what the state did here, and that's what happened.
Let me ask you a question about the sentencing issue. The Supreme Court in Friedland is very vigorous that the trial judge needs to make written findings of fact on the facts that are found that underlie the legal conclusions and the conclusions of law that support an exceptional sentence. And the court is clear that unless those facts are found and reduced to writing by the trial judge, then an exceptional sentence cannot validly be imposed. The U.S. Supreme Court says, other than the fact of a prior conviction, all facts that are predicate to the imposition of an enhanced penalty have to be found by a jury. Make sense of this for me. How can the trial judge make factual findings that are necessary for the imposition of an enhanced sentence if the facts that are found are about anything other than a prior conviction?
Well, in our practice, I think in the practice around the state, we do the best we can, and since Blakely, we take the jury's findings of fact and we incorporate them into the judgment and sentence, as was done here, and the judge executed.
Yeah, but the judge has to make findings in addition to those.
Well, are you referring to the findings that there's substantial and compelling reasons to impose the exceptional sentence?
There's findings of fact and conclusions of law that Friedland tells us are necessary to, and that the judge, in order for the judge to make the legal conclusions that are required, those factual findings that need to be sent to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. How can it be, if those do not involve the fact of a prior conviction, that the facts can be found by anyone other than the jury?
I don't think they can. I mean, as I read Suleiman and regrettably I'm less familiar with Friedman, but I understand the point that counsel's making on that, and my understanding of that is that this was setting the case up to be taken to the Supreme Court to ask for clarification. But it makes sense enough to me that the jury finds the facts based on the evidence presented, and the judge has to incorporate those into the judgment and sentence and make the adequate findings that those facts found by the jury are substantial and compelling reasons in consideration of the purposes of the SRA to impose the exceptional sentence.
And so the court's not making independent findings. The court is incorporating the jury's findings.
Yes, I think so.
Well, then why does the court have to make any factual findings? If it's a pure legal question, the court would not be required. I know that there's cases that say it's a legal question. I'm sorry, Mr. Banks, you just happened to be here today. I know that there's cases.
Well, I was here intentionally, but
yeah. Well, I mean, I know there's cases that say this is just a legal question. But how can it be? How can the Supreme Court be correct that it's just a legal question, where the Supreme Court is also saying the trial judge must make factual findings and must reduce them to writing?
Well, with respect to the Supreme Court, since I anticipate I may be arguing this in front of them, I think they're going to have to clarify that, and our position would be that there has to be a distinction, because I can't there's no point in asking the trial court to make redundant findings of fact. Now, the trial court could reverse the findings of fact, could overrule the jury's findings, I think, on a defense motion, but that's a separate question.
Let me ask the next question, just trying to explore what sort of a mess we have here. If we were to say we're not willing to wait for the Supreme Court, we're going to reverse this sentence now, could we remand it for any purpose under the existing statutes? Or are we in the same position as after Blakely, where they needed the Blakely fix legislation in order to give the jury the authority, the statutory authority in Washington, to make the findings that the Sixth Amendment would require?
So the suggestion would be we'd have to have statutory authority for the court to also make the redundant findings.
And we'd have to have statutory authority for the jury to do it.
Well, don't we already have that? I mean,
only those aggravating factors that are listed in the statute.
Oh.
Yeah.
As to the substantial and compelling reasons.
Now you're with me on what sort of a mess we might have here. We're not sure we have a mess.
Well, we may have a mess.
Yeah.
And my request to this court would be to uphold the exceptional sentence and the findings that were made. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, you're responsible for this.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that there are recent U.S. Supreme Court case law and Washington Supreme Court case law, too, you know, which Hughes and Suleiman were like the immediate aftermath of Blakely, and they were trying to work out some of the
Let me ask you the question that I just asked Mr. Banks. Only I'll ask it more directly because it's more applicable to you. What remedy are you requesting?
To reverse the exceptional sentence.
And
I hadn't thought about sort of the procedural posture, but now that you bring it up, we would be in the same procedural posture in post-Blakely if there's no statutory authority to have a jury finding on this, then there would need to be a legislative fix before the court had that statutory authority, because the authority comes from statute.
But that's for other cases. For this case, what remedy are you requesting?
Well, the remedy would need to be then to reverse the exceptional sentence
and
impose a standard range term.
Okay.
So remand to impose the standard.
Yes.
Range.
Yes.
Suleiman refers to factual conclusions. What's a factual conclusion?
Well, I mean, I think that's
different than a factual finding.
Well, that's where I think Suleiman and didn't really evaded the issue. Really, they were looking at the basic factual determinations of the aggravating factor themselves, but then not the separate factual consideration that judges have to make under the statutory scheme. And U.S. Supreme Court case law since then in Hurst and Alene and such make clear that any facts that are used to elevate that sentence need to be found by the jury, and it's not ambiguous. And so the court's efforts to fit that into some sort of separate judicial fact-finding is simply not valid.
Is there any recognized exception other than the fact of a prior conviction?
There is not, no.
In case anywhere that's allowed anything to be accepted from the requirement other than a fact of a prior conviction?
No, I'm not aware of any. And in Aline, the U.S. Supreme Court, again, reiterated that that's true for any kind of determination that lifts that statutory or the sentencing floor, which applies here. And as this has played out since Blakely, it's apparent that it is a factual determination that our Supreme Court has steadfastly held cannot be something that the court makes on its own. So we ask you to reverse the conviction as well as the sentence. If there are no further questions.
Thank you. Next up.